Hey everybody, this is Brandon Schrand. So I want to apprise you of a few things to be aware of that are going on behind the scenes of the Snake River Killer podcast. First, we're in the middle of a website redesign, which I couldn't be happier about. The new site will be sleeker and will feature a store from which you can purchase merchandise to support the show and to start conversations at your local farmer's market or book club, the gym, your yoga group, favorite bar, or anywhere else you socialize. A large portion of the merchandising proceeds will go to erecting memorial park benches in the names of the victims in the LC Valley. And depending on sales, I hope to expand this project to the cases beyond the valley. The remaining proceeds will go to production costs, which will allow us to move forward without filling each episode with advertisements, an easy optimization that I have chosen to avoid because, well, ads are annoying and they take away from the immersive experience, but I digress. Last, I want to start recognizing fans of the show who have left reviews on Apple Podcasts or who have otherwise contributed to the show. This week, I want to give a special shout out to Holly Holt and her mother, Diane Williamson. Likewise, I want to thank Candace Weaver, Andrew and Lauren Millar, Pat Burns, Chelsea Collings, Barb Bell, Alana Keegan Cooper, and Mackenzie Deanne, all of whom have been stalwart supporters of me and this podcast. So thank you. That's only a few of the people I plan on thanking, so if you've left a review and weren't mentioned here, don't despair. I will get to you. And for the rest of you, yes, I have my eye on you. If you haven't left a review, consider doing so. Maybe you'll get a shout out on an upcoming episode. For now, however, let's dig into this episode, Chicago, 1963. The Snake River Killer podcast is tracking multiple active and cold cases. This investigation is happening in real time. All individuals named and unnamed in this podcast are innocent until proven guilty by a court of law. This episode contains graphic content and sexual and physical trauma of a child. Listener discretion is advised.
Where is Christina White?
Who is the suspect?
Detective Jackie Nichols believes there may be a connection between Christina White's disappearance, the murders of Christina Nelson and Brandy Miller, as well as the disappearance of Stephen Pearsall,
all suspected to have fallen victim at the hands of another. Law enforcement made a critical discovery shortly after the murders of Miller and Nelson.
The man that was working in the theater that night lived at the home where Christina White disappeared from.
He was very odd himself. He was more creepy, scary odd.
Opposed to the drawdown, so I agree with that, being suspicious.
She was on the porch and she waved goodbye, and that was the last time I saw her.
So far, we have tracked the cases of Christina White, who went missing on April 28, 1979, from the Asotin, Washington house in which Lance was living at the time. We have tracked the brutal murder of Kristen David, who sewed costumes at the Civic Theater where Lance was active and who may have also crossed paths with Kristen either at the Circle K in Moscow, Idaho, or at a downtown lounge. And we have tracked the cases of the Civic Theater 3, Christina Nelson, Brandy Miller, and Stephen Pearsall, all of whom vanished from Lewiston on the night of September 12, 1982, and all of whom were in the immediate proximity of Lance on the very evening in question. One important aspect to point out here is that when Lance was questioned by the Lewiston Police Department, he refused to take a polygraph test. On this point, one could legitimately ask, if you were innocent of a crime, why not take the polygraph to clear your name? Recall that Christina White's mother, Betty Eminger, and stepfather, Mick, both took the polygraph and passed with flying colors. What was the rationale behind his refusal, you ask? Because he claimed that newspaper advice columnist Ann Landers said polygraphs were faulty and shouldn't be trusted. So his refusal to take a polygraph is an important detail to bear in mind as we move forward. And speaking of moving forward, we have talked a lot about Lance as the primary person of interest in these cases. His personas of the chivalrous gentleman and the concerned neighbor, the engaged citizen, the thespian and musician, the Dungeons and Dragons enthusiast, the perennially unemployed house husband, the armchair intellectual with a customized soundproof den, the Navy veteran who didn't like the water, the scout leader who thought kids should be seen and not heard, and on and on and on. But when you clear away all of the role-playing and personas and the cleverness that has been associated with him, what are you left with? I mean, who is Lance anyway? What is his story and his backstory? What to make of this chameleonic interloper who never really had a job or any serious responsibilities for decades at a time, and in whose orbit so many lives seem to have been ended or vanished? Is he really a serial killer still walking among us, or just an unfortunate man whose seeming connection to all these cases is totally innocent, nothing more than a curse on the scale of Greek tragedy, the consummate wrong place at the wrong time victim narrative, if you will? What, in other words, is Lance's origin story, and what, if anything, might that story tell us about these cases? Lance's parents, Frank and Jane, grew up in the same Austin neighborhood of Chicago, just 3 blocks away from one another, and would have gone to school together, being just a year apart in age. The couple married in 1941, and Lance was born in November of 1947, after Frank returned home from the war. Lance's father, Frank, however, died 10 months after Lance's birth. Place of death was in Seattle, Washington, where he had been working for Alaskan Airlines as a chief storekeeper. Although still married, at least legally, Lance's mother stayed in Chicago, so it remains unclear as to why Frank was working in Seattle. The cause of his death was congestive heart failure. He was only 31 years old. Lance's mother, Jane, however, excelled in music and won a handful of singing contests around Chicago, and after rearing Lance on her own for 3 years, Jane married a certified public accountant named Joseph in 1951, and the family of three resided in Jane's childhood home, a modest bungalow at 1510 North Linder. You can find a picture of this house and a map on the neighborhood on our website, snakeriverkiller.com, under Resources, Maps, and Case Photos, respectively. Not much is known about Lance in his youth. For instance, we don't know how or to what degree his father's premature death affected him. It's unclear if he had any close friends. Gloria, I know, has reached out to a number of people from that neighborhood, contemporaries of Lance, and few, if any, will really talk. I have been told that he was unusually close to his mother, Jane, and there is evidence that bears that observation out, as we will get to soon enough. We do know that he was involved in music, an interest no doubt passed down from his mother, and that he worked at the neighborhood YMCA as a summer youth counselor. And it was his role as a summer counselor at the Y that is of particular interest when we look at his ties to these cases we are investigating on this podcast. To that end, I want to take you back in time to a potentially critical moment in all of these cases, to what I consider to be possibly ground zero in the Snake River Killer podcast. The morning of August 1st, 1963 was a typical weekday morning for Rita Taylor. In her modest third-story apartment at 5601 West End Avenue in Chicago's Austin neighborhood, she was getting ready for work, putting on makeup, earrings, listening to the news in the background. 30 years old and mother to her only child, 8-year-old daughter Diane, Rita wore dark hair and an olive complexion indicative of her Italian roots. Rita and her ex-husband David Taylor had divorced 3 years earlier, and she was now engaged to an Edward Kruzel, a trim, fair-complected man who served in the Air Force during the Second World War and who had worked in statistics. Rita was a receptionist and worked long days. Because money was tight and childcare options were scant, 8-year-old Diane was something of a latchkey kid, and this morning of August 1st was not unlike any other summer morning for Diane. She would sleep in while Rita got ready for work and would remain home alone in the early morning hours. The arrangement wasn't ideal, but Chicago's Austin neighborhood was by and large a safe neighborhood of middle-class folks and had the feel of a close-knit community. Once ready for the workday ahead of her, Rita left the apartment, shutting the locked door behind her, descended the many staircases to the ground floor, where she then exited the red brick apartment building and stepped into the bustle of the morning commute to work. Later, at 9:30 a.m., Rita phoned the apartment from her office. Diane answered. Rita told Diane that she needed to eat, get dressed, and hustle down to the Austin YMCA for her swimming lessons and crafting and archery classes. Diane said she would and hung up the phone. Because the Y was just a short walk from their apartment, it was a convenient and ostensibly safe place for Diane to spend her summer days while her mother, Rita, worked. Not long after hanging up the phone with her mother, Diane made her way down the same several flights of stairs and headed out of the red brick apartment building. The morning was already warming up, promising a typical August day in Chicago. Diane was wearing a white sleeveless blouse, navy blue shorts, white socks, white tennis shoes, a light blue hairband, and blue eyeglasses with silver flecks. She also wore two small rings, one with a small white stone. And on her person, she carried a keychain with three keys and a small light blue wallet with a shoulder strap. The wallet contained photos of movie stars and her YMCA ID card. At 10 a.m., Diane arrived at the YMCA without incident, and there she joined in the morning's wave of activity amongst the youths. Lance, who was working at the YMCA that morning, was 15 at the time and could be aptly described as gangly, bespectacled, awkward, strange. According to several sources, not only was Lance present that day at the Y, but he was also one of Diane's counselors. 2 hours later, at noon, Diane and a friend walked back to Diane's apartment to eat their lunch. Diane had eaten a tomato and her friend ate a sack lunch she had brought from home. After lunch, the girls left the apartment building, and in about 5 minutes to one, they popped into the Meyer drugstore across the street from the YMCA, where Diane bought a candy bar. They then crossed the street and returned to the Y. Then, at 2 p.m., Diane was trying unsuccessfully to unwrap a lollipop, but needed help because the wrapper kept sticking to the small globe of candy, so she sought the help of a youth counselor. Now here, it gets a little unclear. According to numerous sources, she entered a room in which Lance was reading a book and asked him for help. Irritated, Lance told her not to bother him. Frustrated, Diane in turn kicked Lance and walked out. However, newspaper accounts also note that Diane asked 18-year-old Sue Thorpe, another counselor, to help unwrap the lollipop. My only guess on the differing accounts is that it could be that Diane asked Lance for help only to be shooed away, and that's when she turned to Sue Thorpe. If I get any more clarity on that detail, I will let you know. 10 minutes later, at 2:10, 12-year-old daughter of a YMCA official spotted Diane behind the YMCA walking alone north in the direction of Lance's house at 1510 North Linder, the opposite direction of Diane's apartment, which was due south. Diane was supposed to be in archery class, but for reasons that aren't known, she skipped her class, and that was the last time anyone saw Diane Taylor alive. Later that same evening, at 6:30, Rita returned home from work, letting herself into the apartment, tired from a long day at the office. Calling out Diane's name, she heard nothing. She then did a quick search of the rooms in the apartment and then decided to try outside. Not seeing Diane in any of the usual areas in which she would play or roller skate, Rita likely went back inside, got on the phone, and called around to friends, family, neighbors to see if anyone had seen her. Nothing. By 8:30, Rita was beginning to panic. She lighted out on a frenzied search of the neighborhood, calling out Diane's name, quizzing people on the sidewalks and streets and in stoops and on balconies and porches and on tidy lawns and on asphalt lots and in dime stores and drug stores and at newsstands and in church doors and service stations. Still nothing. The sun had been down for 21 minutes and darkness began to pool in Rita's shaken heart. After an hour of desperation, she then went to the police department to report Diane missing. Without hesitating, uniformed cops began canvassing the Austin neighborhood, conducting door-to-doors, jotting notes, sweeping dark alleyways and littered lanes and underpasses with flood lamps and service lights, dispatch radios squawking in the background. At about midnight, George Timmer was in his home at 1051 North Lockwood when he heard something outside. Well, it was like a low moan and a sound like somebody slamming the door of a junky car, he said. The following day brought no answers. Diane was still missing. Friends, neighbors, and police conducted more searches. Rita was, according to reports, heavily sedated as her friends and family gathered. The same was true for Diane's father and his family, which entailed 10 siblings, all of whom were rocked by the news of her disappearance. Rita's twin sister, Carmela, and father, Joseph, stayed with her to assure her, and if not assure her, then comfort her. Day turned into night, and still, they couldn't find Diane. In the early hours of Saturday morning, August 3rd, the skies over Chicago were black with heavy thunderheads. Lightning spidered over the city. Thunder boomed above while city lights glimmered in the inky black. Rains had battered the window panes of Rita's apartment all night while trains rattled across the city. By 9 a.m., the storm had begun to clear off, allowing the city to awake in a cocoon of gray light. 10-year-old Noreen Malachek was out walking her dog, Blackie, at about 9:30 that morning. Sunlight was finding its way to the cement and warped blacktop in the Austin neighborhood. Fresh rain puddles mirrored the sky and surrounding buildings. And just as Noreen began to pass by the alley near 1048 North Latrobe Avenue, her dog, Blackie, began to bark and tug hard at the end of his leash, pulling fiercely toward a tuft of weeds in the alley. The knee-deep stand of wet alley grasses sprouted out of the ground near an apron of cement that led to a Mrs. William McAvoy's garage at 1055 North Lockwood. McAvoy, a widow, was a neighbor of George Timmer, the man who had heard a low moan and metallic slamming noise in the early hours of Friday. Noreen tried to rein in Blackie so they could continue their usual route, but he was too strong, and despite her efforts, 10-year-old Noreen succumbed to his strength and skittered behind the dog as he zeroed in on the stand of weeds and the unspeakable thing it held. At first blush, Noreen thought she was looking at a life-sized doll, but then she saw the blood and the other things. She shrieked, yanked Blackie's leash, and bolted for home, her heart pounding like gunfire. "There's a dead girl in the alley," she screamed. "There's a dead girl in the alley." The body, as it happens, was about 0.9 miles from Lance's house and 1 mile from the YMCA, almost exactly equidistant. And Lance's home was about 1.3 miles from the YMCA, making a nearly perfect triangle with the location of Diane's body forming the eastern point. When lead homicide detectives Francis Flanagan and the coroner Andrew J. Toman arrived in the alley, they discovered one of the most gruesome sights imaginable. Toman, white-haired, suited with black horn-rimmed glasses and a compact physique, squatted near the body. Diane's hair was wet, as though she had lain there throughout the night's torrents. Her navy shorts, underwear, socks, and white shoes were missing. Also missing were her keys, wallet, eyeglasses, and rings. Her blouse and headband were shoved in her badly battered mouth. She had been strangled, raped, bludgeoned, and stabbed multiple times with a large knife, with the worst lacerations appearing on her thighs and face. Diane was so disfigured from the assault that when Rita was called in to ID the body and asked if the girl was Diane, she froze and said, "I don't know." Then she asked the police officer if the girl had a small mole on the left side of her forehead. She did. And that's when Rita broke. News of Diane's brutal murder rocked the Austin neighborhood and greater Chicago area to their very core. The neighborhood newspaper offered a $1,000 reward for any information on the case. Austin's newly appointed deputy chief of detectives, Walter Carlblom, assigned 24 detectives to work the case day and night, telling them, quote, "Treat this case with more dedication than any other case you've worked on," end quote. He broke the 24 detectives into three units. The first was to work out of the YMCA, the second out of Diane's apartment building, and the third set up their post in the alley where the body was found. Police were especially interested in the YMCA and what appeared to be orange paint flakes under her fingernails. Meanwhile, neighbors and friends of Rita's expressed their horror and grief. Diane was often described as nice but lonely. Mothers were fearful for their daughters' lives and refused to give their names to reporters for fear of being targeted. Everyone was on edge. The local Chicago press ran Diane's case on the front pages for weeks on end. Meanwhile, clues rolled in. Someone found a bloodstained coat in the neighborhood. A boy found some blue eyeglasses in a distant alley. Another found a ring. Each of them, however, became a dead end. Police staffed their headquarters with extra typists, filers, and additional officers to help answer phones and track down tips. They had even secured a mannequin that resembled Diane and had Rita repurchase the exact outfit and accessories Diane was wearing on the day of her disappearance. They photographed the mannequin, circulated the photo to the media, and all of the officers working the case for their subsequent door-to-doors. You can find a picture of this mannequin on our website, snakeriverkiller.com, under Resources Case Photos. Witness accounts were varied and often contradictory and difficult to corroborate. One witness walked by a man carrying a child in his arms and the child appeared to be asleep. Another indicated that an elderly man in a car stopped Diane a few days earlier and asked her to approach the car, saying he had a message for her from her mother, Rita. Diane apparently did not approach the car, however. Possibly the same elderly man was seen watching little kids play at a local park. Someone else had heard a car racing out of the alley at some point during the night. Another individual said they saw a black 1949 Ford leaving the alley at around 6:30 the morning Diane's body was found. Even more interesting, at least to me, was that on the night Diane went missing, a Juanita Robles, age 30, saw some activity at a 12-room abandoned house next door to her own house. The abandoned home stood at 123 North Central Avenue and frequently saw kids in and out of its doors. Moreover, Juanita said she had seen Diane at the abandoned house playing with some kittens on the day before she disappeared. The house could be significant because police determined that Diane had been dead for 36 hours when she was found, which means it's unlikely that her body would have lain in the alley that entire time without being found, and that in turn suggests that she was killed elsewhere, likely indoors and somewhere out of sight. I just have so many questions about this case and all of the witness accounts and tips, as there is just a lot to sift through. That is why I knew it was important to reach out to Diane's half-sister, Denise, to see what she could tell me about the events leading up to and following Diane's murder. This is the first time Denise has spoken publicly about the case. Gloria, who was the first person to find this case and link it to Lance, and who has been in touch with Denise, also joined us on the call.
My name is Denise, and I am Diane's half-sister. We have the same father. Diane was born a few years before me. I was born and raised in Chicago, and I didn't move to California until the late 90s. This all happened before I was even born. So things that you read in the newspaper are probably what I know as well. I might know a little bit more because I did have opportunity to go to the police station. And I know that Rita and my father were separated. My father and mom were already married.
So did you know about it growing up, or is this something you learned about later in life?
I learned about it later in life.
I want to jump in here quickly because the audio wasn't that great, but Denise went on to tell me that it was during her 11th birthday party when a group of her aunts pulled her aside in a separate room and showed her a picture of Diane and told her what had happened.
So it really didn't make sense to me at the time. I didn't know what murder was all about and rape and strangulation and, you know, all the things that happened to her.
So, you know, you're 11, so that's still fairly young, but 11 years and you didn't know. I mean, so there's two ways of looking at that. Was it later in life that you really got interested in this? Because I know you become engaged, or at least that's my limited understanding. You become engaged in this case so much that you contacted the police department. So maybe talk a little bit about that journey.
Yeah, so as soon as the internet came out and I learned how to use it, I just kind of did search for Diane Taylor, you know, murder in 1963, Chicago. And there were just a few articles online. And I was searching and searching. And then I actually did go to the police station one time and ask about it. And they told me records were lost. And that was probably, once again, maybe 1986.
Records were lost.
So then I kind of gave up. I just like, what more can I do? I mean, the police told me being naive or whatever, I just took their word for it. But then I would continue to search, you know, every so often when I would think of it on the internet. And that's actually how I found Gloria. I was searching, and I think it was actually January of 2019 or maybe 2020. I'm not sure. I was searching for her again. And then I read something that the detective that was handling the case at the time had died. And there was one thing that he wished that he could have done was solve this murder. So then I started reading on it more and more. And then I saw this whole Valley.
I'll just jump in here and say that Denise mentioned Cold Valley, which is a two-part documentary series on these cases. And I think it's definitely worth checking out.
And I watched the second episode. I'm like, that's my sister. And this is Chicago. And who is this lady? So I contacted Gloria and she got back to me and kind of put me in touch with my cousin who lives in Ohio, or her dad lives in Florida, which is the last surviving uncle of the 10 kids.
In your search, have you been in touch with anybody that was around at that time that had any perspective on the events that led up to and followed Diane's murder?
Well, I'm on that group. I think Gloria's also on it, the Austin pre-70s.
Yeah, pre-70s.
Yeah, and sometimes the people will post about, oh, I remember her. Nobody has any information that's going to help us. just, I remember her, you know, they don't want to talk.
They don't want to talk.
Maybe they don't.
I got some guff from that group, and this was because I was talking about her murder. I almost got kicked out of the group.
Can I just ask what the resistance is? Like, I don't understand.
I think that part of the resistance is that they are older. It's a bad memory. They don't think anything can be done. And people don't want to get involved either. I did have somebody message me that knew Lance, and her mother had dated Lance. And that's about as far as, you know, you just don't get people to talk. And they wanted to have just happy things in the group and all that. But
gotcha. Maybe they're of a generation of like, why are you dredging this up? Let bygones be bygones.
Exactly.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. You're exactly right, Brandon. And because it is an old cold case, and it just put a dark shadow over that neighborhood.
It did. And it's almost 60 years. This year is going to be 60 years.
When we were filming Cold Valley, the neighborhood it's a rough neighborhood.
Now it is, yeah.
Yeah, it is very rough. We had to have people watch the car so that it wouldn't get broke into. There was a murder that had happened in the field right next to where we parked. And as we're walking down the street and getting the feel for the neighborhood and seeing the building, people that didn't seem friendly wanted to know what it was about. Why are you guys here? Mm-hmm. You know, and I thought that was kind of an odd icebreaker, but I think that that allowed us to do what we had to do in the neighborhood.
Besides the time that your aunts pulled you aside when you were 11 and told you about this, has it been discussed much? Do they have theories on who might have done this, or?
Well, as far as the family goes, it was interesting because when my parents told me, and my aunts and uncles and everybody was surrounding me like they always did, they told me the thought was that their YMCA counselor did it, but they couldn't prove it. So put that together. That's what my parents told me. And then here's something to add on to that, because when I was looking at the police records at the police station that day, at 2:05, Diane went into a room. Lance was in there, and there was another kid in there. And Lance was reading, and this whole thing with the lollipop, we know what that's all about. So she went in there and asked Lance if he could help her take the wrapper off the lollipop, and he didn't want to be bothered, so she kicked him. So that was at 2:05 in the afternoon. And then after that is when she went missing. You can't find anything after 2:15. At 2:15, you see her walking down the alley. I haven't found anything else that anybody saw her after that time.
Walking down the alley going north.
I don't remember which way.
That's what I just read in one of the.
That's what you read?
That could be wrong, but north would be toward Lance's home, and she was the opposite direction. But still, like, where her body was found is sort of almost a midway point between where he lived and, you know, where she lived. And,
yes.
Because she was pretty close to the YMCA. Denise, that's really interesting that your family keyed in on her YMCA counselor, Lance. And it sounds like they keyed in on him independent of you meeting Gloria.
Yeah.
So you hadn't made any of those connections. They were already making those connections. Back then.
Yep.
So I mentioned this to Gloria in a message earlier. I said, I read in the newspaper that a counselor named Sue, I can't remember her last name, was the one that helped her with her lollipop. So I don't know what to make of that. I mean, one thing we know about reporting is it's the first draft of history, and they don't always get everything right. Mm-hmm.
According to the police report, she was asking everybody in the neighborhood to unwrap that lollipop. So if Sue unwrapped it for her, what time did Sue unwrap it? Did she continue asking everybody to unwrap my lollipop because she was getting attention?
Okay.
There's one thing that I did read about her was she was a loner, no siblings. Her mom worked, they were divorced. So she was like a latchkey child at 8 years old. People said that they would see her outside, like first thing in the morning, you know, trying to go talk with somebody, go by people's houses. You know, so, I mean, there's so many unanswered questions that I even have. wish I would have had more time to read over reports because maybe I would have gotten more answers. Unfortunately, those reports have went downtown Chicago and Raytina is no longer there.
Really quick, just for clarification, Denise is referring to the Diane Taylor case files being moved from the Austin Police District down to Central Chicago. And she also references one of the officers who had been assigned to that case. Denise, I know, will be in Chicago toward the end of March, and it's my hope to join her to try to access some of those records, because I would like to see what's in those files. Denise also mentions a binder of door-to-door reports. Also in the files is the interview police did with Lance himself, and I would love to see that.
I went to the police station when I was probably in 1986 to go see if I could find anything. I had went to Chicago, even though I'm in California, my family's still there. And I went to the police station and he gave me the boxes of evidence.
Okay.
Started filtering through them. And in that box, there was a binder like that big. And it had all of the 10,000 police reports of door to door. It was, like you said, so detailed. A lot of people knew her. It was summer. A lot of people were out on vacation, out of town, but she was a loner. And I just felt bad. I felt sad for her.
I know. And it's awful.
They said that she tried to hang out with the older kids. And that brings me back to the lollipop. I'll never forget the lollipop or them white gym shoes. I could never wear them growing up. Them white tennis shoes. I could never, ever wear them growing up. And I used to go to the park after school for playing softball. We had it wasn't a YMCA. It was just a playground. And we had a coach and we had a teach. And the teach was female. And when I would go there, I would hang around her because I didn't want to hang around a coach, a counselor. Because I had the fear in me,
Yeah.
I had the fear in me as well as my parents, because my siblings are older than me. So I was pretty much a latchkey child at the age of 10. Mm-hmm. And I was it was dark. I'm going home because I was afraid that was going to happen to me. I mean, it wasn't just every day. It didn't affect my growing up, but it was just something in the back of my head.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
It was just something in the back of my head.
Here, I just want to thank Denise for her bravery, for coming on the show, and for speaking her truth, because her truth may lead to the truths behind these heinous crimes and their perpetrator. I want to thank her, too, for her transparency and vulnerability, because our conversation turned pretty emotional, as you will hear in the next episode. That said, I still have so many questions, why did Diane skip her afternoon archery classes at the Y? And instead started walking north in the direction of Lance's house. Those, to me, seem to be key pieces of information. Why did she skip her classes, and why was she walking in the opposite direction of her home that afternoon? It could be that someone enticed her to skip her class and maybe meet them somewhere along that route. If that were the case, it would likely have to have been someone she knew or trusted. But also someone who, in turn, knew that she was a bit of a loner and that she probably gravitated to whatever show of attention she could elicit. Stranger still is that the abandoned house was in the opposite direction that Diane was heading. In fact, at the time, it stood some 600 feet of Diane's apartment. To get a clearer sense of these locations, you can find a detailed map on our website, snakeriverkiller.com, under Resources Maps. In fact, the abandoned house was about 1 1/4 miles south of the alley where Diane's body was found. So if she had been killed in that house, the perpetrator would have had to transport her body a fair distance without being seen. But even if she were killed in a different location, the same question applies. How and by what means was her body transported? It's doubtful but not impossible that someone would have carried her, which leaves the necessity of a car. And that possibility raises the question as to whether or not Lance had access to a car at the age of 15. The truth is, we just don't know. Not at this time, anyway. The fact that she had been dead for 36 hours and had orange flecks of paint underneath her fingernails leads me to wonder if that paint didn't come from a house or structure in which she was killed. Again, an unknown. Also unknown is the answer to this corollary question. Why would a killer go to the trouble of moving a body out of such a house or structure and then dump it in an alley? One obvious answer is if the murder was committed in the perpetrator's home, then he would want to get rid of that body. Another possibility is that there may have been evidence at the original crime scene, so the perpetrator wanted to put some distance between the body and said evidence. Officers and reporters both commented on the way she had been placed in the alley, supine, on her back, as if displayed. In other words, her body wasn't just dumped out of a car. It appears from these accounts that there was some intentionality behind it. And on that question of intentionality and everything else surrounding her grisly death, I wanted to turn to our newest team member, Dr. Marianne White, a professor of criminology who wrote her dissertation on serial killers. Specifically, I wanted to get her take on what this crime scene might tell us about the killer.
So to start with, having multiple methods is interesting because we don't see that in most cases. Usually we'll see it was a stabbing or it was a shooting or, you know, it was strangled. But since we saw such brutality here with beating and strangling and stabbing, and it seems like it was, you know, to the point pretty much of overkill, it's kind of interesting. And it makes me wonder if it was more of a younger perpetrator, somebody who was pretty inexperienced. And I wonder if he used multiple methods to kind of get a feel for things and, you know, see what he liked and, you know, kind of what worked for him. All of the methods that were used here are usually seen as being pretty personal in nature, where, you know, you think of somebody shooting somebody, you don't have to be up close and intimate with that person. But in this case, with strangulation and the stabbing and then the mutilation of the body, a lot of time was spent there. And so it makes me wonder if perhaps he knew the victim in some way, or it can sometimes also relate back to some sort of rage that is being taken out on this victim for whatever reason.
And there's also the sexual assault too.
Right.
So, I mean, that's probably its own kind of, right? That's its own kind of thing, I would imagine. I don't know.
Yeah, so a lot of times murders, and even more so when we look at somebody who's committing multiple murders over time, there a lot of times is a sexual component to it. But just like when we look at cases of sexual assault without murder, it's less about the actual sexual component than it is about having control over that other person.
Power.
Yeah, having that power and exhibiting that power and control over that individual.
What I'm hearing you say is that you could potentially be looking at a younger killer trying to find, you know, whatever it is, I hate to use the word gratified, but whatever it is that fulfilled whatever fantasy he had or whatever was going on there. I don't even have the language for it, because it was sort of overkill. It was not just a stabbing. I mean, if we look at the recent Moscow murders, I don't believe there's any indication that any of the victims were sexually violated. That was a straight up stabbing.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of very monolithic approach. It was just that, not that that minimizes that it was awful and horrific. But here with Diane Taylor, you've got the bludgeoning, the stabbing, the strangulation, and the sexual attack. And it brings me also to the putting her headband and her blouse in her mouth. Is that part of the power dynamic? Is that just functional of like trying to like gag her, or is there more to that? I mean, I don't know. I've heard of that kind of thing in other cases. I just don't know how to read that.
Yeah. So in some cases, it can be part of that power and control over the person. But I also wonder if it was more of a functional thing to try to keep her quiet and prevent her from screaming and making any noise. But it could also be, you know, part of his fantasy and, you know, kind of one of those things that we look at as being a ritual, you know, something that is particular to the perpetrator, that individual, and what their fantasy is and how they can fulfill that fantasy. So it's kind of difficult to know, but at the same time, going back to the sexual assault, the multiple methods of homicide, it seems that he spent a decent amount of time with her before then disposing of her body in the alley. So without knowing where that time was spent, it's difficult to determine whether it was particular to trying to keep her quiet or if there was, you know, underlying intentions there.
I don't know about you, but I found what Marianne had to say to be both illuminating and telling. And now that I think about it, the multiple methods of killing and rape do seem to speak to someone who didn't yet know what methods would work for him. Someone, she said, that could potentially be younger. Someone who probably knew Diane, and perhaps someone who had a lot of rage. And that leaves me to wonder if getting kicked by a young girl was enough to trigger such a rage in a 15-year-old boy. Again, to be clear, I am well aware of how murky this case is, how multi-layered and complex, and how time muddies, not clarifies, the proverbial waters, and how there needs to be a lot more in the way of tangible evidence to link Lance to her murder. That said, there is one thing that could potentially put Lance at the scene, and that thing is a grainy black and white photograph that was splashed across the Chicago newspapers in the days after Diane's murder. The photograph shows the crime scene, with a few cops and some onlookers in the alley where Diane's body had been found. Everyone within the frame of that photograph is looking in the same direction, away from us. They are looking at the place where her body was found, in that stand of weeds. There is, however, you should know, one individual who is not looking at the crime scene, but who instead is looking the opposite direction. Who is looking straight at the cameraman, straight at you and me. The individual is that of a tall, gangly, bespectacled boy, about 15 years old, who is slinking out of the right-hand side of that picture frame. That boy's likeness is the spitting image of Lance himself at that age. If you haven't seen that picture or photos of Lance at the time, you need to, and you can find them on our website under Resources Case Photos. And when you peer into that photograph and everything that is going on within the four corners of that image, the stare of that teenage boy will give you chills. It certainly did for me. The Snake River Killer is a production of Resuscitate Media, LLC. I'm the host, Brandon Schrand. Original music is written and performed by the Young Night Drifters. Special thanks to Blake Walker, our engineer. Associate producers and investigators Gloria Boberts and Paul Dale. Graphic designer and content contributor Samantha Sawyer. Research consultant and criminologist Dr. Marianne White. And research assistant Tina Landry Oddie. Special thanks to Jennifer Anderson and Vernon Locke for letting us air portions of their documentary, Confluence. Be sure to check us out online where you can subscribe to the show and find resources, photos, timelines, articles, links, and more. Next time on The Snake River Killer. Hi there. Are you with the police?
Yes.
You are? Can you release anything publicly about what's been found so far?
Well, 1:40, I issued a press release. Unfortunately, today that's all that could be released. Both, obviously under investigation.
I would think that if the offender were to take some sort of trophy, that it would be maybe one of those things. You know, take her eyeglasses to keep, take her wallet or, you know, whatever. I would imagine that they wouldn't take all of those things to keep as trophies because that seems like a lot that could come back to be evidence against them.
Maybe the two of you can walk us through what led to her body being exhumed and then did anything come of it?
Yes, Chicago PD. They went ahead, they opened the case because of what happened back then and then looking at Lance's history after Diane Taylor's murder, they felt that perhaps they could get some kind of DNA or something off of Diane's body.
Well, I would say, when are we reinterring her? And it wasn't done until November of 2020. They lowered her in the ground because she's buried next to her grandma. And as they were lowering her in the ground, I looked up and you can see in the video, as they're lowering her in the ground, my son pans to me and I'm looking up in the sky. It wasn't raining hard. It was just like a mist in the air and it was just so cloudy. And out of all the clouds, just a light of sunshine came. So I'm thinking to myself, she's going home.